You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, November 1st. I'm Fiona from Drake University. Here is our first story. Over half of Pot County has shots. By Tim Rower. Most already fully vaccinated against COVID-19. More than half of Pottawamie County residents are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. The latest information from the Iowa Department of Health and Human Service shows about 54.1% of residents are up to date with their COVID-19 vaccines. That's higher than some southwest Iowa counties, but about average statewide. Pottawamie County residents who are still in need of COVID-19 vaccines are encouraged to make arrangements through their doctors or pharmacies that currently offer such vaccines, according to the local public health department. To find a local business or medical clinic offering COVID-19 or influenza vaccine, go to vaccine.gov. The federal government recently ended the distribution of free COVID-19 vaccines to the state and local agencies, leading to a transition to the commercialization of the vaccine, said Maria Siak, the county's public health administrator. However, federal grants providing funds for COVID-19 vaccines for eligible children and adults who have no insurance or are underinsured has continued. Siak said she recommends those individuals contact her office for more information. Meanwhile, her office continues to offer vaccines for the flu for the general public. Approximately 800 doses of flu vaccine were ordered, Siak said. We have plenty on hand and we can order more, she said. Shots are available to the public and cost $20 for those who have no insurance. Otherwise, people should check with their insurance company to determine if they can cover these vaccines. We do take walk-ins, she said. The public health office is located at 600 South 4th Street. It offers after-hour vaccination clinics on the fourth Tuesday of each month from 4 to 6:30 p.m. There is also a picture included taken by Joe Shearer Photos for the Nonpareil, and it's depicting Paul Kearney Left, father of a recent St. Albert High School graduate, Connor Kearney, receives his second dose of the COVID-19 vaccine from a registered nurse, Rachel Tieford Wright, inside one of the school's libraries on May 28, 2021. Iowa Mobile ID app is now available to be downloaded. By Caleb McCullough, Lee Gazette, Des Moines Bureau. Iowans can now download an app that can be used as a digital version of their driver's license at businesses across the state. The Iowa Mobile ID app can be used to verify a person's age for purchasing alcohol and tobacco, as well as for identification at certain TSA pre-check checkpoints at Iowa airports. Iowa is the first state in the nation to roll out a mobile ID with a large number of businesses across the state capable of accepting the ID. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said in an Iowa DOT release, I'm so proud of the DOT and the Department of Revenue's Alcoholic Beverages Division working together on an innovative solution that provides convenience and added security for Iowans as they use their IDs for a variety of purposes. The app was originally slated for release in 2022, but new updates in technology and best practices delayed the development of the app. The app is now available for download on both the Apple App Store and Google Play Store. Innovation and technology underpin our work to make lives better through transportation, and I am pleased to showcase another example of this from our department, Iowa DOT Director Scott Marler said in a statement. According to the DOT release, the app is a companion to the physical card and does not replace it. The agency said Iowans should still carry their physical card. Where can the Iowa Mobile ID app be used? The app can be accepted by businesses that use the Iowa Alcoholic Beverages Division Age to Purchase app. Iowa Department of Revenue Director Mary Moisman said in the release that integrating the two apps will lead to quicker adoption. So far, 18 businesses have told the DOT that they are ready to accept the mobile ID, according to a list on the agency's website. Iowa residents can also use the mobile ID at TSA PreCheck at the Des Moines International Airport, Eastern Iowa Airport, and many other airports throughout the country. Other businesses that use the ID verification app will be able to accept Iowa Mobile ID. Iowans should look for the Iowa Mobile ID logo on businesses' business doors and at a point of sale, the agency said. As with any new technology, the transition to widespread use will ramp up over time, the agency said in the release. The app cannot be used as a valid form of ID when voting, a spokesperson for Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pat said. How do I set up the Iowa Mobile ID app? After downloading the app, users will be asked to register with their phone number and scan their physical ID. Users will then need to submit a photo of themselves to verify their identity. Users will be asked to create a PIN or use biometrics to secure their mobile ID. When asked to present their ID, a mobile ID user can click a button in the app to share their identity, which will pull up a QR code that the business can scan. They will then be asked to accept or reject the business's request for their information. Users can also choose how much information to share. For example, they can share their age with the business without revealing their address. How is my data secured? According to the DOT's website, the Mobile ID app does not permanently store personal data, other than an encrypted version of the user's driver's license, number, and phone number as a record locator. The information accessed by the app is stored with the Iowa DOT. There's also a photo attached depicting the mobile ID can be used the same way you use your ID to verify your age or identity. Now with your mobile ID, when you are asked, "Can I see your ID?" you will display an encrypted QR code from the app. DOJ takes on JetBlue-Spirit merger by David Koning. The Biden administration's fight against consolidation in the airline industry was tested Tuesday as lawyers for JetBlue Airways and the Justice Department squared off in court. The administration is suing to block JetBlue's proposed $3.8 billion acquisition of Spirit Airlines. The trial in federal district court in Boston could reshape the market for low-cost airlines. Spirit is by far the nation's biggest budget carrier, and it will disappear if JetBlue wins the case. As the trial began with opening statements from lawyers for sides, share of JetBlue were suffering their worst one-day drop in more than 3 years after the airline reported a wider loss than expected in the third quarter and predicted another surprisingly large loss for the fourth quarter. Executives declined to take questions about the Spirit deal. CEO Robin Hayes said it would be inappropriate while the matter was being debated in court. The Justice Department is fresh off a victory in a previous lawsuit that killed a partnership between JetBlue and American Airlines. JetBlue isn't exactly the sort of behemoth that comes to mind when imagining a defendant in an antitrust case. It is the sixth largest U.S. airline by revenue, and it is trying to buy the seventh biggest. If it swallows Spirit, JetBlue will leapfrog Alaskan Airlines, but still control less than 10% of the U.S. air travel market. It would remain far smaller than American, United, Delta, or Southwest. But if JetBlue gets its way, it will grow its fleet about 70%, repaint Spirit's yellow planes, and make them less cramped inside. The New York carrier argues that it needs Spirit to bulk up and compete better against the bigger airlines. JetBlue toots itself as one of the most disruptive and innovative companies in the history of the airline industry, and says it can bring down fares if it can go head-to-head against the Big Four on more routes. The Justice Department argues, however, that Spirit is disruptive forces that need to be protected. Consumers are better off with an independent Spirit, not a JetBlue intent on removing seats from planes and charging higher fares, government lawyers argued in their pre-trial brief. They say the harm will fall hardest on cost-conscious consumers. JetBlue says the vacuum left by Spirit would be filled by growth from other discount airlines. The Justice Department says that is unlikely because, like all airlines, including the budget carriers, face limits to growth, including shortages of planes and pilots. Spirit, which is based in Miramar, Florida, is known as the ultra-low-cost carrier, the name given to the airline that toot rock-bottom fares but make up for it by charging high fees for things like checking a bag or carrying one on board. Spirit even charges for soft drinks. Personal finance site NerdWallet said passengers should expect to pay $137 in fees on a typical one-way flight, compared with $35 or less at the bigger airlines, including JetBlue. This isn't the first time the government has challenged an airline merger. In 2013, regulators sued to the top of the merger of American Airlines and U.S. Airways. The deal, which created the world's biggest carrier, went through without a trial. However, after the airlines agreed to give up some of the gates and takeoff and landing rights at seven major airports, JetBlue tried that strategy. It offered to divest gates and landing and take off rights and gates in Boston, the New York City area, and Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to Frontier and Allegiant. The government scoffed at the offer, saying those discount carriers have pledged to fly the same routes that Spirit flies now. The Biden administration may be having remorse for mergers that the Obama administration allowed to go through and which eliminated Northwest, Continental, U.S. Airways, and AirTran as competitors to the four largest U.S. airlines. Before the current case, the Justice Department sued to quash a JetBlue-American partnership in which they shared revenue from flights in New York and Boston. The new trial is taking place in the same Boston courthouse where the Justice Department prevailed against JetBlue and American, but the case is being heard by a different judge. It is expected to last until early December. In New York on Tuesday, executives of JetBlue Airway Corp. blamed bad weather in September, air traffic control problems, and rising fuel prices for the company's $153 million loss in the third quarter, a wider loss than expected. JetBlue forecast an adjusted loss of 35 cents to 55 cents per share and lower revenue over the last 3 months of the year. Analysts expected a loss of 15 cents per share, according to a FactSet survey. The shares fell 13% Tuesday, on track to be the worst single-day performance since March 2020, when the impact of the coronavirus pandemic was starting to be recognized. There's also a picture. A JetBlue Airbus A320 left passes a Spirit Airline Airbus A320 as it taxis on the runway July 7, 2022 at the Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. The Biden administration's fight against consolidation in the airline industry will be tested Tuesday with lawyers for JetBlue Airways and the Justice Department due in court. The trial in federal district court in Boston could reshape the market for low-cost airlines. Spirit is by far the nation's biggest budget carrier, and it will disappear if JetBlue wins the case. White House launches new virtual tour by Darlene Superbill. Can't come to Washington? Couldn't get a trip to the tour of the White House? Don't worry. The White House, Google Maps, and Google Arts and Culture have launched a new virtual tour of the famous mansion. With a computer or smartphone, users will be able to see all of the rooms that they would have seen had they been able to go on a public tour of the building. The updated virtual tour is part of a mission by First Lady Jill Biden to make the White House accessible to many people as possible. Biden, a longtime community college professor, hopes teachers will use it to educate students about the White House and its history, said Elizabeth Alexander, her spokesperson. Not everyone can make the trip to Washington, D.C. to tour the White House, so she's bringing the White House to them, Alexander said. The tour is the first Google virtual tour of the White House to include audio captions for people with disabilities. The captions are narrated by White House Social Secretary Carlos Elizondo and pop up on the screen to offer viewers historical information on each of the rooms. It is also Google's first virtual tour of the White House to have Spanish translation. The tour opens with a brief video of President Joe Biden and the First Lady welcoming visitors, the same message that plays at the White House Visitors Center for those who visit in person. Google Street View technology was used to capture the imagery, starting at the East Wing entrance and moving through all the rooms on the public tour route, including the library, the China Room, the green, blue, and red rooms, the East Room, and the State Dining Room. The tour was created using Google Arts and Culture Storytelling Tool. Ben Gomez, a senior vice president of learning and sustainability at Google, said the mission of its arts and culture division is to open the world's culture to people everywhere. The tour is available on the White House website as well as on Google Maps and the Google Arts and Culture page. There's a picture attached. The First Lady, Jill Biden, speaks Tuesday in the state dining room at the White House in Washington ahead of Wednesday's state dinner with Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. Israel hits refugee camp. Military continues its ground invasion to seek Hamas militants. By Najib Jobain, Jack Jeffrey, and Lee Keith. Khan Yunis, Gaza Strip, a flurry of Israeli airstrikes Tuesday on a refugee camp near Gaza City, leveled apartment buildings, leaving craters where they once stood. as ground troops battled Hamas militants across northern Gaza and attacked underground compounds. The Hamas-run Interior Ministry said at least six airstrikes destroyed a number of apartment blocks in Jabalia, and it reported a large number of casualties but did not immediately provide details. The Israeli military said Tuesday it carried out a wide-scale strike in Jabalia on Hamas infrastructure that had taken over a civilian building, and that tunnels underneath the building had collapsed. It said the strikes killed a large number of Hamas militants. Israel said two of its soldiers were killed in fighting in northern Gaza, the first military deaths reported since the ground offensive into the tiny Mediterranean territory accelerated late last week. With several hundred thousand Palestinians still in the northern part of Gaza, Israeli troops and tanks reportedly advanced on several sides of Gaza City, the sprawling urban center. Casualties are expected to mount as the battle moves into dense residential neighborhoods, even as overwhelmed hospitals in the north warn they are nearing collapse with supplies largely cut off and strikes hitting nearby. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejects calls for a ceasefire and again vowed to crush Hamas's ability to govern Gaza or threaten Israel after its October 7th rampage, which ignited the war. In the Jabalia refugee camp, a densely built-up area of small streets on Gaza City's outskirts, footage of the scene from Al Jazeera TV showed at least four large craters where buildings once stood, amid a large path of rubble surrounded by partially collapsed structures. Also on Tuesday, the Israeli military said troops took control of a Hamas military stronghold in West Jabalia, killing 50 militants. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem denied the military's claim, saying it was just trying to justify its heinous crime against civilians. More than 8,500 Palestinians have been killed in this war, mostly women and minors, the Gaza Health Ministry said Tuesday. The figure is without precedent in decades of Israeli-Palestinian violence. Over 1,400 people died on the Israeli side, mainly civilians killed during Hamas's initial attack, also an unprecedented figure. Militants also abducted about 240 people during their incursion and have continued firing rockets into Israel. UN Chief Guterres visits Nepal. Official speaks before Parliament warns of melting glacial ice. The UN chief said Tuesday after touring the highest peaks in Nepal that the world should end the fossil fuel age to curb what he says is a devastating level of melting of glaciers in the Himalayan mountains due to global warming. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addresses Nepal's parliament after flying past Mount Everest, the world's highest peak, on Monday and touring the base camp of Mount Annapurna, the world's 10th highest, on Tuesday. Glaciers are melting at records. I was a witness, Guterres said in his address. The effect is devastating. Swollen lakes bursting, rivers and seas rising, cultures threatened, and mountainsides exposed, inflaming the risk of rock slides, landslides, and avalanche. Guterres visited towns including Pokhara, where trekkers begin the journey in Mount Annapurna region, and met with local groups to discuss environmental issues, including protecting the Himalayan glaciers that provide fresh water to more than a billion people. I am here today to cry out from the rooftop of the world, stop the madness, Guterres said. The glaciers are retreating, but we cannot, he said. We must end the fossil fuel age. A report this year by the Nepal-based International Center for Integrated Mountain Development said Himalayan glaciers could lose up to 80% of their volume if the Earth warms by 4 degrees Celsius in coming decades or centuries. Guterres urged countries to stick to commitments under 2015 Paris Climate Conference to control carbon emissions to keep warming down. We must act now to protect people on the front line and to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, Guterres said. Scientists warn that flash floods and avalanches could become more likely in the coming years, in part due to climate change. Guterres also appealed to the international community to donate funding to help build resilience in affected communities. There's also a picture attached of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres visiting Annapurna Base Camp Tuesday in Nepal. Leaders urge Congress to aid Israel, Ukraine. Administration wants $105 billion largely to spend on conflicts abroad. The nation's top military and diplomatic leaders urged an increasingly divided Congress on Tuesday to send immediate aid to Israel and Ukraine, arguing at a Senate hearing that broad support for the assistance would signal U.S. strength to adversaries worldwide. The testimony from Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken to the Senate Appropriations Committee came as the administration's massive $105 billion emergency aid request for conflicts in the two countries encountered roadblocks. While there is bipartisan support in the Democratic-led Senate, the request faces deep problems in the Republican-led House. New Speaker Mike Johnson proposed focusing on Israel alone and defunding the Internal Revenue Service to pay for it. President Joe Biden requested $14.3 billion for Israel, $61.4 billion to support Ukraine, $9.1 billion for humanitarian efforts in Gaza and elsewhere, and $7.4 billion for the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. is focused on countering China's influence. The White House also wants about $14 billion to protect the southern U.S. border. Affidavits detail possible motive in Maine shooting. Gunman thought others accused him of being a pedophile. Maine State Police documents released Tuesday shed light on why a delusional U.S. Army reservist who killed 18 people may have targeted a bowling alley and a bar in Lewiston. Robert Card, 40, was found dead Friday, 2 days after a rampage that wounded 13 people and shut down multiple communities during a massive manhunt. 3 hours after shooting began, state police interviewed a woman who said Card believed that the just-in-time recreation bowling alley, Schmanigee's Bar and Grill, and several other businesses were broadcasting online that Robert was a pedophile. The woman said Card was delusional since February after a breakup, had been hospitalized for mental illness, and prescribed medication that he stopped taking, according to an affidavit. Card's brother and another man told police Card had been in a relationship with someone he met at a bar. Card's son told police paranoia about strangers calling him a pedophile began a recurring theme for his father since last winter. Children in and around Lewiston were back in school and went trick-or-treating Tuesday after last week's lockdown. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, November 1st on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Fiona from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. So there actually are no obituaries listed in today's edition, so now we will be moving on into sports. Rangers road streak alive. Texas won win from first title after holding off Diamondbacks 11-7. Marcus Semien's two-run triple and three-run homer powered Texas to a 10-run lead by the third inning. Corey Seager hit another long home run, and the Rangers beat the Arizona Diamondbacks 11-7 on Tuesday night to take a 3-1 lead in the World Series. Rangers batters whipped through Diamondbacks pitching like a desert storm, taking a 10-0 lead and becoming the first team in the series history with consecutive 5-run innings. Seager's third 2-run homer of the series capped the second. Semien's drive punctuated the third, and Jonah Heim added an 8th-inning shot. Texas improved to a record 10-0 on this road this postseason and moved within one win of the first title in the 63-season history of the franchise that started as the expansion Washington Senators in 1961. Nathan Eovaldi tries to close out the third all-wild card series on Wednesday night after Zach Gallen in a rematch of the Game 1 starters. 42 of 49 previous teams to take a 3-1 lead have gone on to win the World Series. The most recent club to overcome a 3-1 deficit was the Chicago Cubs against Cleveland in 2016. Texas scored its first 10 runs with two outs, bettering an Arizona staff that needed four pitchers to get its first eight outs. Miguel Castro's wild pitch brought home the first run, and an error by Gold Glove first baseman Christian Walker, the first by either team in the series, led to five unearned runs in the third. Seager and Semien, all-star middle infielders, signed as free agents for $500 million combined before the 22 season. They have six RBIs each in the series. Seager, the first shortstop with three series homers, has four homers in his last five games dating to the AL Championship Series. After leading the Los Angeles Dodgers to the 2020 title, he could join Sandy Koufax, Bob Gibson, and Reggie Jackson as the only two-time World Series MVPs. Travis Jankowski, replacing injured slugger Adolis Garcia in right field, singled in the second and hit a two-run double in the third in his first series at-bats. Garcia, the AL Championship Series MVP, spoke at the Rangers pregame meeting. "We're trying to go out there and win this for him," Seager said. "It really fired the guys up." Andrew Heaney, a 32-year-old lefty with his fifth big league team, got the win by allowing four hits in five innings. Six relievers followed, with closer Jose Leclerc getting the final out. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. hit a sacrifice fly in the fourth for Arizona and a three-run homer in the eighth against Chris Stratton. Tommy Pham had a sacrifice fly in the eighth, and Gabriel Moreno delivered a two-run single in the ninth. There was a festive mood at Chase Field, where the roof was open for the second straight night. Some fans arrived in Halloween costumes, but many started booing in the second inning. Arizona's Ketel Marte had two hits, extending his record postseason hitting streak to 20 games. Now we're moving on to the lifestyle section. Humor: how do you like them apples? Jerry Zima. "An apple a day keeps the doctor away, but if I keep eating apples every day, I'll need a doctor because I am full of apples right up to my, you guessed it, Adam's apple. I have been consuming the fruits of my labor since my wife Sue and I went apple picking and carted home a bag full of apples, 42 in all, that I am eating every day in some form or another. I have an apple, Gala, Delicious, McCune, or Granny Smith, all from the orchard, for dessert at lunch. I also consume a bowl of the apple crisp that Sue made for dessert at dinner, and she just made an apple cinnamon bread pudding for when the apple crisp is finally finished. In our house, apples are like the biblical tale of the loaves of the fishes. Eat one and two more appear. You've heard of Johnny Appleseed. I'm his cousin twice removed, Jerry Applehead. Actually, I love apples, and I like to go apple picking, which we do every year. Last year, I was hit in the eye by an apple that fell from a high perch and could have blinded me. I wasn't hurt, but I ended up being the apple of my own eye. This year, I wasn't subjected to an apple attack, though I came perilously close to rupturing a vital organ while lugging a heavy bag of juicy, ripe fruit around the orchard, and the circulation in my fingers was nearly cut off while folding the bag by the handles. But that didn't stop me from sampling apples for sustenance, of course, while traipsing among the trees and trying to avoid the hordes of other people who had the same idea. Apple picking is a family tradition that dates back to when our two daughters were kids, and it has continued with their kids, who love adding apples to my bag or my basket, which is even harder to lug around, and watching the top ones fall out and roll away. Sometimes I step on them and create instant applesauce, one of the many fine recipes that can be created when the apple pickers get home. Others include apple pie, apple cookies, apple muffins, apple cobbler, apple bread, apple strudel, apple tart, apple fritters, apple rolls, apple Betty, apple Gillette, apple dumplings, apple scones, apple pancakes, apple butter, apple chips, baked apples, candied apples, and apple sausage, which Sue just made for dinner, although she bought it at a store. It's enough to make you want to have a good stiff drink of Applejack. I would be remiss if I didn't mention other pick-them-yourself fruits, which include strawberries, peaches, and the autumn favorite, pumpkins. Farm stands have road signs that proclaim, pick your own. I have been tempted to get out of the car and in bold letters write, nose. Sue always stops me. A couple of years ago, I met the Strawberry Whisperer, a woman with a large personalized basket festooned with drawings of strawberries onto which she put a mound of berries the size of bocce balls. The ones I picked, which I plunked into a pathetic little basket provided by the farm, looked like glorified raisins. You have to pick from underneath, she advised me. The ripe ones like to hide. I didn't blame them. Pumpkins are more practical because you only need one, although you will have to carry it about half a mile to your car. Once you get home and put it by the front door, the squirrels will eat it. Of course, you can always grab a steak knife and risk severing a major artery while carving a scary face in the pumpkin for Halloween. If you put a candle inside, it will illuminate the bloodstains. But for now, we have all those apples to finish. I may have to call a doctor after all. On nutrition, why kids love sweets. My 9-year-old grandson recently told me the bits of spinach in my tortellini soup were his worst nightmare. A bit overdramatic, don't you think? This kid has no problem downing any sweet treat that comes his way. However, why do kids have such a strong preference for sweets? We are born with it, experts say. It's his initial taste for sugar that may drive us to seek our first food. Human milk is high in the natural sugar lactose, an easily digested source of energy that also promotes the growth of beneficial bacteria in an infant's gut, according to a 2019 consensus article on lactose in the journal Nutrients. American children aren't the only ones who love sweets. A 2021 article in the Journal of Sensory Studies stated that a child's heightened preference for sweetness is universal across cultures. Granted, these kids are growing fast and need extra calories. Nutritionally, though, the amount of sugar most kids consume has clearly crossed the line. Starting at age 2, kids and adults alike are recommended to eat no more than 10% of our daily calories from sugar. According to current dietary guidelines for Americans, their consumption is certainly well above that limit. A moderate intake of added sugar for my active 9-year-old grandson, for example, is no more than about 160 calories from sweets each day. That computes to about a fourth cup of Skittles, and not in the place of more nutritious foods. How do we do that without being overly restrictive, which can often backfire into worse habits? A 2020 research article in Obesity Science and Practice found some strategies that may help. This family-based study reported that when moderate amounts of candy were made available in the home, and children were also taught to savor the flavor and be more mindful about eating these foods, the kids actually ate less of them. Oh, and parents also had to stop using candy as a reward. Mindful eating takes time, and that's the point. Try this when kids come ready to devour a bag of Halloween candy. Take one piece, slowly unwrap it, smell it. Suck on it for 10 seconds or take a small bite and enjoy the taste. Eat it slowly and think about how yummy each bite tastes. Kids need to experience a wide variety of foods, even spinach, in their formative years. Not to put on any pressure, but experts say our adult preferences are shaped by the experiences we had as children. As my grandfather used to say, too much of anything, including Halloween candy, is not good for you. Our goal, then, is to help our kids develop a healthy respect for food and learn to eat goodies in moderation. Good luck. Dealing with loss can be a challenge. Recovering from the grief of loss is difficult for some more than others, but we all feel it. When a true friend or love has passed away, rebalancing life can be a challenge. When you speak to or see someone every day and suddenly they're no longer there, it leaves a gap in your psyche and heart. This isn't just an acquaintance I'm talking about, someone you may say hello to on your way to work, but someone who could be your very best friend, someone you speak to every day about everything. The love you have for this person is still alive in you, which can be painful when the person is gone. You now have to learn a new way of being. For many, this is like learning to walk again. Perhaps you never realized how much you leaned on someone who is no longer with you. When partnerships end like this, whether suddenly or not, you feel it deeply. Even if someone else comes your way, you may not be able to take in fully what they have to offer. You also may not have a lot to give in return right now. It's not your fault. This is simply part of the grieving process. You must give yourself the time to let your mind settle and grasp what you've lost and what you need to do to make yourself whole again. The time you used to spend with the one you've lost will need to be filled in some way, but not right away. You have to be kind to yourself when you're hurting. You also have to make sure that you don't let yourself slip into depression, even though it's natural to be somewhat down. If you find that you no longer want to engage in normal activities or can't stop grieving, you should consider some counseling or a grief support group. Finding the right balance between appropriate grief and overwhelm can be difficult for even the most keeled person. Only you know how you are truly doing, but if friends tell you that you've seemed too sad for too long, you need to consider their words. It is important to grieve. We need to let ourselves mourn a big loss. Most people get back to some type of normal within a few weeks. This is a new normal, of course, because your life has changed so dramatically. But over time, you'll feel more comfortable. All of this may be part of some grand plan, but that can be hard to see when you're in the middle of it. Trust that you will come out of the darkness and find more love in your life to focus on. People can't be replaced, but you can treasure the love you had for the person who is no longer there. And when you are ready, you will be able to share your love again. Dynamic duo, men's basketball. Duke spent much of its first season under John Scher building to another Atlantic Coast Conference title, yet it was Miami that outlasted the rest of the league in March for the program's first trip to the Final Four. They are the ACC headliners to start the 2023-2024 season, with the second-ranked Blue Devils eager to live up to projections as a national title contender and the 13th-ranked Hurricanes aiming for a third straight deep postseason run. For Duke, that means relying on the preseason Associated Press All-American Kyle Filipowski inside and a strong NBA draft prospect in Tyrese Proctor among four returning starters to go with another top recruiting class. Scher, in his first full season as Mike Krzyzewski's successor, led Duke to the program's league record 22nd ACC tournament title before falling to Tennessee in the second round of the NCAA tournament. "We have a core group returning," Scher said. "You can see our freshmen can really help us and can really play. We need to continue to find roles." The ACC title included pushing past the Hurricanes in the semifinals, but the Hurricanes went on to follow an unexpected run to the Elite Eight in 2022 by reaching college basketball's final weekend. They returned three starters from the group in guard pack as the top returning scorer, forward Norchard Omier, and guard Wuga Poplar. "We are not where we're going to need to be defensively and rebounding in order to compete with the best teams in the league and some of the best teams in the country," Coach Jim Laranga said. "My staff is doing a great job of explaining to our players what needs to be done in order to get where we want to be. Now it's going to be up to the players to do that, to work at really getting better at defense and rebounding." And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. I'm Fiona from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.
This is Tom Hatton with an Irish short take from the book A Culinary History of Iowa. An article we're reading now is entitled Manna Colonies Maintain Rich History in Iowa. The Icarians weren't the only communal society to play a role in Iowa's culinary history. The famous Manna Colonies in eastern Iowa were also founded on communal principles. But unlike the Icarians, the Mannas had a strong religious component. By the 1700s, people across northern Europe had become dissatisfied with the rituals and intellectualism of the Lutheran Church and had begun to rebel and separate from the Church. Adherents to a new faith called the Community of True Inspiration formed their own self-reliant communities. Known as the Inspirationists, these men and women and their families found refuge in central Germany. Persecution and an economic depression in Germany in the 1830s, however, forced the community to search for a new home. Hundreds of Inspirationists immigrated to America in 1843-44 in search of religious freedom. They pooled their resources and established a community named Ebenezer near modern-day Buffalo, New York. All property was held in common. Farms and factories were established, and the community of nearly 1,200 people prospered. When more farmland was needed for the growing community, the Inspirationists looked to Iowa, where attractively priced land was available. A committee was sent to inspect land in Iowa in the mid-1850s. The Iowa River Valley proved particularly promising. Here, the men found acres of rich soil, good timber, water, limestone, sandstone, and clay necessary for establishing a new community. Leaders chose the name Manna, meaning remain true, from Song of Solomon 4:8. Starting in 1855, six villages were established a mile or two apart, including Manna, East Manna, West Manna, South Manna, High Manna, and Middle Manna. The village of Homestead was added in 1861, giving the Manna colonies access to the railroad. Each village had its own school, farm, and craft industries to make it virtually self-sufficient. The communal way of life was continued in Manna, much like it had been in Ebenezer. All property was held in common. Families were assigned housing in buildings owned by the Manna Society. Each individual worked at a designated job. Religious life was the strong unifying factor. In the seven villages, residents received a home, medical care, meals, all household necessities, and schooling for their children. Property and resources were shared. Men and women were assigned jobs by the village council of brethren. No one received a wage. Farming and the production of wool and calico supported the community. But village enterprises, from clockmaking to brewing, were vital. Well-crafted products became a hallmark of the Manna colonies, which are still known for exceptional wines and more. People were called to work before dawn by the gentle tolling of the bell in the village tower in Old Manna, where the pace of life was much different than today. More than 50 communal kitchens provided three daily meals, as well as mid-morning and mid-afternoon snacks to all colonists. These kitchens were operated by the women of the Manna colonies and were well supplied by the village smokehouse, bakery, ice house, and dairy, as well as the orchards, vineyards, and huge communal gardens maintained by the villagers. During the growing season, there was plenty of work to do in the gardens and kitchens, from planting and harvesting to preparing and storing vegetables, from cabbage to turnips. Around 1900, for example, it wasn't unusual for the communal kitchens in just one Manna village to produce more than 400 gallons of sauerkraut. It took a lot of food and labor to sustain the villages within the Manna colonies. Children attended school 6 days a week, year-round, until age 14. Boys were then assigned jobs on the farm or in the craft shops, while girls were assigned to a communal kitchen or garden. Work and faith were often intertwined and were intertwined in the villages, where the Inspirationists attended worship services 11 times per week. Times were changing by the early 20th century, however. Improved communications and transportation in the 1920s began to exert their influence on the Manna colonies. In addition, the collapse of the American economy following the stock market crash of October 1929 left no aspect of daily life untouched. The Great Depression and disastrous farm economy made the isolated communal life in Manna socially and economically impossible. In the early 1930s, Manna set aside its communal way of life. A strong desire on the part of the residents to maintain their community finally propelled the change, according to Amana history shared by the Amana Colony's Convention and Visitors Bureau. By 1932, the communal way of life was seen as a barrier to achieving individual goals. Rather than leave or watch their children leave the community, the people of the Amana villages changed. Members voted to abandon the communal system and established the Amana Society Incorporated, a profit-sharing corporation to manage the farmland, mills, and larger enterprises. Private enterprise was encouraged. While this separated the economic aspect of the community from the church, the Amana Church Society continued to be the religious foundation of the community. Today, the seven villages of the Amana colonies are among the state's most popular tourist attractions. Declared a National Historic Landmark in 1965, the Amana colonies attract hundreds of thousands of visitors annually who come to experience a place where the past is cherished and hospitality is a way of life. The streets of the Amana colonies, lined with their historic brick, stone, and clapboard houses, their flower and vegetable gardens, and their lanterns and walkways, recall the Amana of yesterday. Many museums are available for tours, including the communal kitchen in Middle Amana, preserved just as it was on the day in 1932 when the last communal meal was served in the colony. The communal kitchen lets you step back in time. Guides explain kitchen routines and share insights on communal life. Guests can also enjoy a satisfying taste of Amana history and hospitality at the famous Ox Yoke Inn, a full-service restaurant founded in 1940 in the village of Amana. The Ox Yoke Inn's nationally recognized reputation of fresh, quality food served family-style reflects the restaurant's old-world signature dishes. The Ox Yoke Inn serves traditional German and American favorites at breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as on Sunday brunch buffet. Glimpses of the past are also preserved in some of the gardens in the Amana colonies. With the passing of the old order in 1932, the number of the society's large vegetable gardens and orchards dwindled, but Larry Reddick and his wife Wilma still grow some of the colony's heirloom varieties in their fourth generation South Amana vegetable garden. In 1980, they founded a seed bank to preserve heirloom plants for the future generations. In his 2013 book, Gardening the Amana Way, Reddick's chapters on modern vegetable and flower gardening in today's Amana colonies showcase his cottage and the meadow gardens, now listed with the Smithsonian's Archives of American Gardens. Old intermingles with new across Reddick's gardens as heirloom lettuce keeps company with the latest cucumber variety. It's a living tribute to the unique history of Amana colonies and one of America's longest-lived communal societies. And that was an excerpt from a culinary history of Iowa by Darcy Doherty, Malsey, and other offbeat stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. With half a dozen measles outbreaks currently underway in the U.S., as well as several serious international outbreaks, the news on measles vaccine from Denmark is important. Researchers conducted a nationwide study that included everyone born between 1999 and 2010. With more than 650,000 children in that group, they had more than 5 million person-years of follow-up. The Danish health system keeps excellent records on all of its citizens, including the children. Consequently, the scientists are confident that the 6,517 children diagnosed with autism during the study period are all the children who developed this condition. Children who did not receive the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or MMR, were equally likely as vaccinated children to develop autism. The investigators conclude, the study strongly supports that MMR vaccination does not increase the risk for autism, does not trigger autism in susceptible children, and is not associated with clustering of autism cases after vaccination.
The Food and Drug Administration has just approved a completely new type of antidepressant. The nasal spray, called esketamine, is expected to help people who have not responded to standard antidepressants. It will be marketed under the brand name Spravato. This drug is chemically related to the injectable anesthetic ketamine that's been on the market since 1970 and is available generically. Although esketamine is administered as a nasal spray, people will not be permitted to purchase it for home use. They will need to use Spravato under medical supervision at a clinic or doctor's office. Some experts have challenged the FDA's approval process for esketamine. While two clinical trials demonstrated some benefit, two others did not show that esketamine is better than placebo. Side effects of this novel antidepressant include nausea, dizziness, headache, and a feeling of dissociation.
FDA Commissioner Dr. Scott Gottlieb unexpectedly announced his departure from the agency this week. Experts were puzzled by his announcement since he has received high marks from the administration, industry, and even some consumer groups. Dr. Gottlieb has raised questions about teen vaping and has been an outspoken critic of pharmacy chains that sell tobacco products to minors. Some commentators speculate that these stances might be related to his abrupt departure. His explanation for the sudden departure is that he wants to spend more time with his wife and young children. Dr. Gottlieb is a survivor of Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Another week, another drug recall. Many lots of ARB blood pressure drugs, including Losartan, Valsartan, and Irbesartan, have been recalled over the past 8 months. These medicines were contaminated with potential carcinogens known as NDMA and NDEA. Now, Hetero Labs has recalled 87 lots, and Tarrant Pharmaceuticals Limited is recalling 100 lots of Losartan tablets. These pills contain an entirely new contaminant just identified as NMBA. It, too, is a suspected carcinogen. All three of these nitrosamine contaminants are apparently created as a result of the manufacturing process. FDA Commissioner Gottlieb stated, "We're making important strides at understanding how these impurities form, and we're continuing to examine if nitrosamine impurities may also arise during the manufacture of other ARB drug products. The FDA is committed to implementing measures to prevent the formation of these impurities during drug manufacturing processes in the future."
Cocoa flavonoids may have some benefit for people with multiple sclerosis, according to a small study. Previous research showed that dark chocolate rich in cocoa compounds might improve symptoms of chronic fatigue. The investigators recruited 40 people with relapsing remitting MS to drink cocoa every day for 6 weeks. 19 of them got high flavonoid cocoa, while 21 drank low flavonoid cocoa. At the end of the study, those on the high flavonoid cocoa had slightly less fatigue and could walk somewhat farther in 6 minutes than they had at the outset. They also reported less pain. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Exploring science and the sea. The big ships that ply the Indian Ocean and South China Sea help power the world's economy, and they also may help power the weather. In particular, they may seed the formation of tall clouds that produce lightning, twice as much lightning along their shipping lanes as in the surrounding ocean. Researchers were mapping lightning strikes in that part of the world when they noticed something odd. Two straight lines where there were far more lightning strikes than average. They compared those maps with traffic along the shipping lanes and found that the two matched perfectly. The ships themselves probably account for the extra activity. They don't actually produce lightning. Instead, they belch out solid particles that form the seeds for raindrops. Their diesel fuel contains a lot of sulfur. Small particles of the sulfur climb high into the atmosphere. Water vapor coalesces around them, forming droplets. These droplets are smaller than those formed around other particles, so they're carried higher into the atmosphere. They climb high enough, in fact, that they freeze. As these tiny ice crystals move, they generate an electric field. Eventually, that creates a discharge, a bolt of lightning. The researchers haven't found a relationship between ships and lightning in other oceans. Shipping lanes elsewhere may be wider, or they may not carry as much traffic. And conditions in the Indian Ocean and South China Sea are better for building tall clouds, including those powered by ships. Science in the Sea is a production of the University of Texas Marine Science Institute and is available as a weekly podcast at scienceandthesea.org. I'm Holly Brawley.
Some would call 88-year-old Sally Jackson a lucky senior.
A few years ago, a family member offered to move in and care for Sally so that she wouldn't have to leave the comfort of her own home.
But soon after, one of Sally's neighbors, Carol, paid a visit, unannounced.
Something wasn't quite right.
Sally's demeanor and physical appearance had changed.
Luckily, Carol was aware of warning signs that might signal elder abuse.
Such as bruises, poor hygiene,
isolation, depression,
appearing withdrawn or unusually quiet, as if to hide something.
When victimized, elderly people often feel ashamed, confused.
But an alert neighbor helped Sally.
Not all abused seniors are as lucky as Sally Jackson.
McGruff the Crime Dog here. The National Crime Prevention Council wants to help you and your loved ones prevent elder abuse. Know what to look for. Know how to report it to local law enforcement agencies.
To learn more, go to ncpc.org/seniors. That's ncpc.org/seniors. A message from the National Crime Prevention Council and the U.S. Department of Justice.